In the 15th chapter of Genesis, at which we were looking in our last study, there is a verse, verse 13, in which Abraham is told in advance of the Egyptian captivity that was to last 400 years. I think this was passed on in that family. You see, Joseph, you have several generations. There's going to be Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. But Joseph, the real ruler down in Egypt, we're told in the book of Hebrews, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel, and that's right here too, and gave commandment concerning his bones, that his body was to be taken back. I take it that this means that this became common knowledge in Abraham's family, which says to some of us older people that there are some things that God has promised and some things that God has already done that we should be sure are passed on in our families. Now, in chapter 16, Abraham's son still hasn't arrived. And Sarai, later she's going to be Sarah, is very concerned that she doesn't have a son. And so she says to Abraham in chapter 16, I want you to marry the maid, Hagar. Now, this was according to the custom of this time. It was a regular procedure when a lady didn't have a son. She would ask the husband to marry her handmaid, if she had one, and Sarai did. And so Abraham agrees to this. And Ishmael eventually is going to be born of this marriage. This marriage caused trouble from the time of the marriage until this day. There was conflict between Hagar and her mistress. You see, when Hagar, this maid, realized that she was going to be a mother, she begins to look down upon her mistress, who didn't have any children. And that's the way these ladies felt about motherhood in that period of time. And eventually, she is going to be so mistreated by Sarah that she runs away. And we're going to have down the page the story of how the angel came to her and said, Hagar, where'd you come from? Where are you going? And she tells him, and then she is told to go back to Sarah. And she goes back, and of course, eventually, Ishmael is going to be born. Now, this story about Ishmael is used by Paul as an illustration in Galatians 4. He's going to say that we Christians, like Isaac, are children of promise, free, heirs, and things like that. And that folks in Paul's day who just wanted to be slaves to the law and make keeping the law a way of salvation, the way the Pharisees did. He said, you're like children of Ishmael. He was really a slave because his mother was a slave. And he says, we are like Isaac. And then in this passage, we won't discuss it at length today because we're talking about Genesis. But Paul's going to say that our mother is the Jerusalem that is above. And if you'll compare that with passages in cross-references in Hebrews, you'll nail it down that Paul's talking about the church. The Jerusalem which is above is free, which is the mother of us all of us Christians. Here's a church as our mother. We receive life by the work of the Spirit, yes, but it's associated with the church. And the church is to train her children, to guide her children and her young people. And you know, mothers keep on looking out for their children. I haven't seen her for a couple of hours, but I know a mother who's up in her 70s. And one of her main concerns at this age is guiding her children. Oh, I don't mean she tells these 40-year-old children exactly what to do, but very much she is still their mother. Here's the work of the church. Now, when Abraham was 99 years old, God came to him again and promised that he would be the father of a multitude of nations, that his descendants will be kings and things like that. Here in chapter 17, in verse 7, there is a phrasing which describes the covenant relationship so beautifully. I will establish my covenant between me and thee, between God and Abraham, and thy seed after thee in their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. Here's the heart of the covenant relationship, that God is going to be a God to these people, and they are to be just that, God's people. Now, you have exactly the same thing in the 20th chapter of Exodus, which the Bible calls a covenant, the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt, and so on. That's the first thing in the covenant relationship, that God is to be our God, the God of our days and years, the God of our lives, the God of our time, the God of our talents, the God of our opportunities, the God of our social lives, the God of our work, the God of our homes, and of everything. And so, in a very real sense, this is a passage that tells us what it means to make a covenant with God. Now, some of you will remember I've mentioned several times that we've lost this word covenant in translation. It's used hundreds of times in the Old Testament and often in the New Testament, and it got translated into Greek as diatheke, into Latin as testamentum. They dropped off the U-M and gave us the English word testament. Perfectly good word. I don't want to change it. I say my Bible's made up of the Old Testament and the New Testament. But in this translation process, we've lost the word covenant. Now, happily, the idea in the covenant relationship is kept in other phrasings. Oh, yes. But here's the idea that the covenant is, first of all, that God is to be our God. In Luther's language, that we're going to give to God the place of God in all of our lives, and we, in turn, are going to be His people. Now, at this point, Abraham's name is going to be changed. It had been Abram up to this point, and that's the way it's spelled, A-B-R-A-M, in the first part of Genesis. And God says your name is to be changed from Abram, which means exalted father, to Abraham, that we call him. And Abraham means the father of a multitude. I've heard preachers say that in that situation, Abraham or Abram would have to call the servants together and say, "Men, God's told me that I'm to change my name." And they'd say, "Exalted Father, Abram, what's your new name going to be?" He said, "My new name's going to be the father of a multitude." That's what Abraham means. And the suggestion's been made that they said, oh yes, but when they got together, they said among themselves, you know, the old man's losing his mind. He doesn't realize he's 90-some years old, and he doesn't have a single child, and they didn't count Ishmael, really. And now he thinks he's going to be the father of a multitude. Yes, but God's the one gave him this name. And, of course, he became the father of multitudes. Now, perhaps we should notice here in this 17th chapter that a long section tells us that there is to be a sign of the covenant relationship. Every male among these people is to be circumcised. This is the outward sign of the covenant. The book of Colossians associates this with baptism. Baptism is the outward sign of being a member of the church, of the body of Christ. And again, Paul puts these two together in the book of Colossians. Now, the sign is just something for folks to see. I learned this in World War II. They assigned me to the old 41st Division, and the patch, the shoulder patch of that division for I don't know how far back had been the swastika. And then the Nazis adopted the swastika as their sign. And you know what the folks in the 41st Division did? They got rid of that swastika so fast that you wouldn't believe it. Well, it was the outward sign of that division. That's the way some of the older people listening to this will remember seeing it back around the time of World War I and thereafter. And you knew which division this man belonged to because of the patch on his shoulder. Yes, but the significance of this patch got changed when the Nazis picked it up. And so they... Now, it's not that something drastic happened to circumcision, but in the Christian church, there is a new outward sign of the covenant. God's people are to be at heart His people, first of all. And then, of course, the outward signs have their place. A wedding ring isn't a wedding. A wedding ring doesn't make a marriage. Rich man could go down and buy 100 wedding rings, and that wouldn't mean he'd have 100 wives, or even one for that matter. And yet, the wife wants to wear her wedding ring. She should. It's an outward symbol, and baptism is an outward thing that the New Testament has told us to practice. Now, in the same chapter, God makes some more promises to Abraham. Among other things, He promises to bless Ishmael, the son of Hagar, the maid. And there's the promise that Isaac will be born, and so named. His name's going to be Isaac. And at this point, Abraham has three visitors. It's verse 18, for those of you who are following in the Bible, of chapter 17, and following that. And verse 19 of chapter 17, Sarah thy wife shall bear thee a son, and thou shalt call his name Isaac. And things like that. And then down it's in chapter 18 that we have the visit of these three angels. They're called men, and later on angels. They were evidently angels in the form of men. And so they come to Abraham, and they have some things to tell him. But there's a long section here about Eastern hospitality, how Abraham welcomed these people, how he got water to wash their feet. Now, that was the regular thing to do in polite society when folks walked on dusty roads that weren't paved. And then, of course, he provided bread, and he got a calf killed, and they had veal and fresh bread. But there's a big thing about washing the feet. Now, that's going to come in the New Testament at the Lord's Supper. Jesus is going to take the basin and wash the disciples' feet. He's going to take the servant's place. He's going to say, "If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, ye ought also to wash one another's feet." Christians are to be servants. And he says, "I've given you an example." He gave us an example of being a servant. Now, the book of Hebrews talks about this particular chapter, and it says, "Be not forgetful to entertain strangers. Remember to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares." Now, I know they're called men, as we were mentioning a while ago, but in the book of Hebrews, it turns out that these were angels in human form. We ought to entertain strangers, not just because we might meet some interesting people. I have never heard that it's actually taken place, but I think the way to illustrate this is to say it would be very possible for somebody who went to one of the old colleges up in Middle Virginia to meet another person who graduated from one of the old colleges in East Tennessee. And they could have a discussion about their schools, and one of them would say, "You know, we've got a wonderful gymnasium on our campus that was given to us by a visitor that was so kindly treated and entertained." And the other one would say, "Uh-uh, that's our story. That happened on our campus." Well, there'll be a few folks listening who'll know, and that's perfectly all right. It's took place on both of these campuses. Entirely different visitor. And I've had a little connection with both of these schools in the last 40-some years. But it's not just that somebody might give you a building. Oh, no. This is what Abraham does in his culture. But the New Testament says we are to do this as Christians. Then there's going to be the renewal of the promise of Isaac's coming. And this time it's spelled out that Isaac's going to be born next year. Then these men or angels leave after they've eaten now, after they've fellowshipped and talked with Abraham, and start towards Sodom. And they are going to tell Abraham, God's going to tell Abraham, that Sodom must be judged. Sodom is to be destroyed because of its wickedness, because of its immorality, particularly its homosexuality. And the New Testament makes it perfectly clear that God hasn't changed his mind about sin. The first chapter of Romans would spell it out, that God still judges because of this kind of immorality. But Abraham's reaction when he remembers that nephew Lot is down in Sodom, his reaction is to start praying for this place. "God, if there are 50 righteous folks in Sodom, will you spare the city?" And God says, "Yes." "Well, God, suppose there are 5 lacking. Suppose there are just 45 righteous folks there. Will you spare Sodom?" "Yes." "God, suppose there are 40, 30, 20, 10. And God says, "Yes." But you see, in all of Lot's family and servants, there were not 10 righteous people. and the city was destroyed. Now, this tells us about our attitude toward America and toward the rest of the world. Abraham prayed for those folks headed for judgment. We ought to pray for such people. I know about all the good folks in America now. But we ought to pray for folks that have this attitude. You see, so very much in the last 20 years, we've had in this country the approach, I got a right to my own lifestyle. And if I want to be homosexual, that's my business. Well, there's one thing you're leaving out. This is God's world, and God said no. God says this is wicked, and Christians should be clear about this, because it's spelled out so clearly in the New Testament. Then, when Isaac is promised, this chapter tells us that Sarah was listening. Now, this is in the tent before they start down toward Sodom. And Abraham, you see, in polite procedure, is walking with them. Abraham had been told about Isaac's birth, and Sarah was listening in the next tent, and she laughed. And the angel eventually is going to say, well, how come you laughed? And she's going to get scared and denies it, and he's going to say, nay, but thou didst laugh. Here's a lady that was slow to believe God's promises. You see, these people had their imperfections. Abraham had faith. And we're going to be told over in 2 Peter 2:7 that Lot, down in wicked Sodom, was a righteous man. God delivered just Lot, is the phrasing in 2 Peter. Like Abraham, we ought to be concerned about these folks in Sodom. These folks that are not Christian. These folks that are compromised and things like that. Now, you know that Sodom and Gomorrah were down at what's now the lower part of the Dead Sea, the southern end of it, in the fairly shallow water. All kinds of material have been dug up down there. The Dead Sea, you see, is 1,280 feet below sea level. And it's had so much material washed in that the water is about 30% solids. Normal seawater would be a little over 3% solids, the salt and all the rest of it. And there's a story in Roman history in 70 A.D. Titus sentenced a group of people to death. They were chained together and thrown in the Dead Sea off of a cliff. And in that kind of water, they just floated back to the shore with the chain on them. And he didn't know what to do with them but to unchain them and turn them loose. Anyway, the Dead Sea is a low place in a fault in the earth's crust. It extends from up near Galilee down through the Gulf of Aqaba and on down across the water into Africa. And it's in an earthquake region. Now, there's archaeological evidence that there was an earthquake about 1900 B.C., after which the region sank and was nearly deserted for hundreds of years. A Phoenician priest, this has nothing to do with the Bible, but it's just history, named Sanchuniathon, wrote in his book, The Veil of Sidimus, and that's what this is called in Genesis 14, sank, became a lake, always evaporating and containing no fish, and things like this. We know from modern archaeological finds up in Syria in the last 10 or 15 years, that Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboiim, these cities of the plain, were real places on the map. They were well known around the world at that time. I'm talking about the library that was found at Ebla or Marduk. And they're going to come to Lot, and they're going to find him in Sodom, these angels. And Lot, like his uncle, you see, Lot was the son of Abraham's brother, is going to be hospitable. "Turn in now, my lords," he says, "unto your servant's house. Tarry all night, wash your feet, and in the morning you can go on the way." And it says he pressed upon them greatly, and they go into his house, and he made them a feast, just as Abraham did. This was a regular thing in that culture. And so here's Lot in the wrong place, and we're going to talk in our next study about, Lord willing, how Lot had been conformed to the world. The big lesson of Lot, I think, for us is just that. We should not be conformed to this world, as Paul tells us in the 12th chapter of Romans.